Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to a brand new episode of the Good Governance Partnership podcast. November 15, 2020. Amidst the trade tensions between China and the United States, China has forged the largest free trade agreement in the history of the world, together with 14 additional APEC countries. This Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, in short RCEP, encompasses the 10 ASEAN countries, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and of course China. Together, the 15 countries intend to gradually reduce trade barriers and tariffs. As we are able to tell from the countries participating, the economic projections are impressive. 1/3 of the total economic output and more than 2 billion consumers. This trade agreement affects every third person on the planet in one way or another. And the historically competing regional main powers, China, Japan, and South Korea, are part of the same trade agreement for the first time in history. This new deal will likely increase China's influence in the economically fastest growing region in the world even further. And the drivers of growth in that region are the countries of ASEAN. So, what does this agreement mean from a geopolitical and economic perspective? Who benefits from RCEP the most, and is this agreement that is inspired by the European Union framework yet another indicator that the future lies in Asia? I am delighted to discuss this and many more questions today with our esteemed guest. She is director at the European Union Center in Singapore at Nanyang Technology School. She is also Council Secretary at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs and member of the Advisory Board for European Studies at the Australian National University and the Leiden University's Asia Center. We are delighted that you have taken your time on a Saturday to speak with us about the role of ASEAN in the world and the links between ASEAN and Europe, and of course your new book, ASEAN-EU Partnership. A very warm welcome to our show, Dr. Yo Lei Wee. Dr. Yo, first question, where are you based right now?
I'm based in Singapore. Okay. At the Nanyang Technological University.
All right, and how is the situation regarding Corona in Singapore and the place you live at?
Well, we have done quite well in terms of trying to get the numbers down. You know, when it first started in January, February, we were able to keep the community down. But of course, then we have an outbreak within the migrant workers' quarters, which really spiked up the numbers. But we have also managed that pretty well, and now we are having only about 3 mostly imported cases. Okay. Community transmission is almost up down to 0 or 1 or 2 per case.
So
2 cases per day.
So pretty much under control, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Dr. Lei Wee, now living in Singapore, you obviously get an impression on the vibe and the spirit in the country at the moment. How would you describe that? How is it to be living in Singapore right now?
Well, you know, we are a small city-state. You know, we are a nation, but also a city. And I think that gives a lot of challenges during this time with all the trade war and protectionism growing. But I think we are still optimistic that we can continue to prosper in this kind of environment by working on transforming our economy, focusing on the financial sector and the manufacturing sector, which is still doing well. So, of course, the COVID-19 has resulted in huge impact on our economy. You know, as a city state, we need to maintain a very open economy. Globalization has been a force of good for us. We have a leverage on that to grow our improve the livelihood for the people. But now, with this whole trend towards deglobalization, we're now, of course, focusing on the regionalization process, working within ASEAN and, of course, RCEP that you mentioned in your introductory remarks, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, to continue our, because we believe that the only way for us to prosper is really to remain open and to leverage on the forces, on the rule-based order for us to be able to do well in this world.
Yeah. Now, speaking about Singapore and looking at the global power architecture, what we are observing obviously is that there is a shift from away from a unipolar world order very much dominated by the United States towards a very multipolar world order where different players are much more powerful than they used to be before, and where the US by far is not the only major global actor, right? How would you describe Singapore's role here, considering that the country has very much benefited from the close relations to the US? And how would you say can Singapore deal with the increasing Chinese influence that has continuously fostered also with the RCEP agreement, for instance? Would you say that Singapore is caught up between two different important blocks and powerhouses? Or would you say that it still serves as a gateway to Southeast Asia and Asia in general?
I would put it this way. I think Singapore is a bridge between Europe and Asia, and also between the different cultures. You know, we are a multicultural society with Chinese, Indians, Arab, Malays, and so we are a multicultural society with different religions, different ethnic groups living harmoniously together. And I think we have been able to leverage on that to build our reputation as a sort of a gate, not just a gateway, but actually a bridge for different cultures to come together. We have always tried and played that role. Even during the worst Cold War era, you know, although we have no diplomatic relations with China at that moment, we continue to trade with China. So we have always been taking, in terms of trade, we are taking a very pragmatic approach. We do not think that the ideological contestation or the ideological approach is the best way. So we try to be pragmatic. We work when we can work together, when our interests coincide. When we have the same interests, we can work together. And I think, for instance, if you look at the issues facing all of us now, like climate challenges, You need to, all of us need to work together despite whatever ideology or political systems we have, right? So I think Absolutely. In that sense, Singapore is always taking the very pragmatic approach and try to be the bridge between the different groups. Our approach is always that there are always, if you have the political will and the imagination, we can always find some common interests and focus on areas where we can work together. Of course, we have differences, but these differences sometimes can be put aside for the common good of addressing some of these common challenges.
Yeah. So Singapore maintains its geopolitical and geoeconomic importance in the region. And of course, it does not only provide access to Asia, but more specifically, of course, it also provides access to the ASEAN countries. And now looking at this ASEAN framework, I would like to actually ask the same question, because the dynamic is pretty similar. On the one hand, you have countries that are politically and economically strongly dependent on China, specifically in the last years with Belt and Road investments alongside the Mekong River, in Cambodia and in Laos, and also in Vietnam. But at the same time, you have close relations with the United States and historic relations with the United States in the past. How would you say, as ASEAN, going to position itself in this new emerging multipolar world order, where economically speaking, there is tremendous interest to collaborate with the US, but also with China when it comes to economic, to the economic development of the domestic markets? So put it in a nutshell, what is ASEAN's role in a multipolar world order, and how can the ASEAN countries balance the different interests?
I mean, if you look at the history of ASEAN has always been driven by the founding of ASEAN was driven by the geographical realities of being squeezed between big powers, right? And I think when ASEAN was founded, the whole idea is that we don't want to become pawns in this chess game of big powers. So we have always been a very political, geopolitical organization in that sense, right? Externally focused. We wanted to make sure that we are not caught in this a big power rivalry, and that we lost our own autonomy. So I think right from the beginning of the founding of ASEAN, that was the whole thing that drives the leaders of ASEAN to come together and say that we have to find some way to manage this kind of tensions and rivalry. So right from the beginning, so this is not new to us. This whole geopolitical contest, the contest tensions between big powers, we always, I mean, the whole objective, the goal of ASEAN is to how to manage all these differences so that we can retain our autonomy, continue to pursue the path of economic and political development that we would like to pursue on our own, on our sovereignty. So it's not new. The geopolitical, of course, the tensions are more sharp now. And of course, the world is so much more complex. So that has, the degree of the complexity has changed. But this whole multipolar world that we talk about, I mean, we have always been trying to navigate. And Southeast Asia has always been multipolar in the sense that we have always different powers being interested in the region. We have China right at our doorstep. During the Cold War era, you have Soviet Union coming to Vietnam. You have the Americans, of course, in Philippines, as you said, and in Thailand and all that. So we have always learned to manage all these tensions. The key difference I feel, and I in some way I worried about now, is that while in the earlier days there was strong leadership within ASEAN to manage all this and to strike consensus and learn how to manage the rising tensions. Unfortunately, we are now at a stage where a lot of the Southeast Asia, the ASEAN member states are facing with a lot of domestic challenges. And these domestic challenges and political wrangling takes the attention away from the leadership to look at the external environment and to manage it as well as we did last
could you,
time.
Could you maybe name one or two examples for specific countries?
For instance, if you look, I don't know whether you've been following what's happening in Thailand now.
Absolutely, exactly.
With the demands for reform on the monarchy. You have in Malaysia all the political wrangling over, you know, trying to topple the prime minister with the different coalitions. So I think the domestic challenges, I think that the key difference to me is that the domestic challenges now are much more stark. And the leaders of the ASEAN countries, they are not as strong as in the... Of course, you can laugh at it and say, well, when ASEAN was founded, precisely because they were authoritarian states, so that the leaders have better control. Now that we are all democracies or some sort of a democracy, so you have the leaders who have to respond to the different demands and challenges. And so a lot of energy and attention is put on domestic. And of course, you can't fault that. I mean, in politics, a lot are because of domestic, you have to put a lot of attention on domestic issues. And so... with those, so you have, of course, one can say you can walk and chew gum at the same time, meaning that, you know, you can be have one eye on the domestic issues but still pay attention on the external environment. And I think there are a few countries trying to manage that. And advantage maybe of ASEAN is that we are not such a legalistic and tight institution like the EU. So there's a certain flexibility with different formula. We call it the ASEAN minus X, ASEAN plus. You know, so we try to be pragmatic that when there are issues, so we have this kind of leadership in various different coalitions, right? So sometimes you have three or four of the ASEAN member states taking the lead to address some of the issues. Sometimes we have a bigger issue where we need to have ASEAN plus another dialogue partner like the EU or Japan to try and resolve this issue. So I think in that very pragmatic and constructive way, we have found ways to try and manage some of these tensions through the different configurations or what we call the variable geometry of international relations.
And do you view RCEP as a result of that? Because many experts obviously tend to describe the RCEP agreement as pretty much a trade extender for China, to put it very simply. I mean, I'm not really sure what to think about that, but I think it is unquestionable that there are some geoeconomic and geopolitical interests also involved in China participating in this deal. And we've seen also India dropping out at the agreement because they were worried about the strong position that China has specifically with regards to the import markets and Chinese products. So how do you view this criticism towards this contract?
I think, you know, it's a common misperception that the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, is a China-led initiative and therefore will be used by China to entrench its interests and influence in the region. Actually, this is not correct. RCEP, the genesis of RCEP is actually, you can trace it back to the ASEAN summit back in 2011, when ASEAN leaders discussed how, you know, the various, because we have a lot of ASEAN plus one agreement, as I mentioned. So we have ASEAN China, ASEAN Japan, ASEAN India, you know, ASEAN and Australia, New Zealand. So the discussion started is to how can we try and bring all this ASEAN plus one agreement into a common framework for a wider regional and more comprehensive economic agreement. So, and this was how it started. So in 2012, I think ASEAN leaders and the other counterparts from the RCEP agreement, Australia, New Zealand, China, Korea, Japan and India, then adopted a joint declaration to say that we would like to see the conclusion of this regional comprehensive economic partnership agreement by the end of 2015. Unfortunately, it has taken us more than another 5 years before we concluded this year. And of course, the other unfortunate incident is that India decided to withdraw or to not to sign up to opt out of the RCEP at the last minute. So with India out of the picture, of course, it would be easy to assume that China would sort of dominate. And of course, this is a risk that ASEAN faces. But don't forget that it's also Japan, which is the third largest economy in the world.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So I think for ASEAN to benefit from RCEP, ASEAN must really continue to secure leadership of the RCEP's implementation. So we were the one who initiated it. Now we have to focus our attention to make sure we take ownership and take leadership in the implementation of RCEP. Yeah. And of course, this will begin with like educating and engaging the business communities in ASEAN about the benefits of RCEP. And there's a lot of work to be done.
Now, you touched on the fact that India opted out from the agreement, which is very important to our listeners, of course, as well. And the question is, why did they decide to do so? What we read, and we already touched on that in a sense, is the worry that cheap Chinese products are going to flood all the other economies. And at the end of the day, the only country that really benefits from any trade surpluses, in a sense, is China. And considering that India as well is a major economy in the region that has close relations in service and also production exports to other countries, it seems to be disadvantages. Now, is the door still open for India? And if yes, how would RCEP look like if India was part of this construct?
It's very clear that the RCEP leaders have kept the door open for India to join anytime when they feel ready. I think the problem with India, I felt, is sometimes the lack of confidence. I think much of the disagreement comes in the agricultural sector and also in the service sector, where they want to have this service agreement where they could have their engineers and their software engineers being able to enjoy the sort of mobility in the RCEP economies. And I think these are some of the issues which couldn't be resolved, unfortunately, and they have decided. And And so they decided to pull out last minute. But like we said, the door is open for them anytime that they felt ready and confident enough that they can they are competitive enough to be able to benefit from the RCEP from the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement.
Now, in the West as well, we hear a lot of skeptic voices about RCEP, specifically from the US and also from some European countries, claiming that it's just a facilitator for China to expand its footprint. Apparently, there are some similarities between RCEP and the European Union. I mean, it's the main goal, obviously, is trade harmonization. It's not a similar set of countries, but the structure is quite similar. You have a very heterogeneous set of countries with different cultural identities, different economic structures, different religious beliefs, and so on. And still, the approach seems to be, even though inspired by the EU, very different. So you don't have a monetary union. Even the trade facilitation does not occur on the same level as in the European Union. Would you say that for Asians, nevertheless, for the participating countries, this development, this contract, is a symbol to the rest of the world that Asia is continuously unifying, coming together, and starting to present itself as a strong bloc of nations?
I think RCEP is definitely a trade agreement that were in some way cement again Asia as the hub of economic activity, especially so-called East Asia, right? And I think that is quite a clear signal to the outside world that, you know, Asia or East Asia remains as a hub of economic activities. We remain open and we will continue to. So this will increase the prominence of Asia, East Asia, as the so-called economic motor or the driving force of global economic development. So that to me is a good thing. So what I hope that RCEP would do is really to catalyze, for instance, there's the EU-ASEAN FTA, the European Union-ASEAN FTA, the inter-regional FTA, which would be tremendous, has been suspended. And there has been a lot of discussions and working groups looking into whether this can be revived. So we hope that with the conclusion of the RCEP, the European Union would also begin to realize that ASEAN is really, the economic potential of ASEAN is really huge. And that, as a bloc, it will be it's the fifth largest economy with more than 3 trillion, the GDP.
So
the potential for rapid growth. Of course, pandemic has put a stop to, put a break on this, but I think we were still, the outlook is still positive. And so we hope that with RCEP, I think somehow it will catalyze much more attention from the EU towards trying to conclude an EU-ASEAN FTA as soon as possible. And RCEP also shows that, we are capable, or ASEAN is capable of agreeing to a very comprehensive, of course, seen from the Western perspective, again, they like to think that, oh, RCEP is not a very high quality agreement. But if you look at the 600 over pages of the agreement in RCEP, I think they include a lot of things on investment, environmental, and all that. So I think hopefully with RCEP, we will see again a revival of, certain competition is good, a certain revival of this competition, and to say we also need to be in the race to leverage or to make sure that all these economic opportunities and things to allow to again restart or sort of give the global economy a push.
But now the trend of protectivism is rather emerging, right? And if we speak about an European trade agreement with RCEP, which of course from many different reasons makes a lot of sense, the question that I'm asking myself is if the exact worry that cheap Chinese products could flood Indian markets, for instance, and other domestic markets in the region, destroying or at least harming these economies. How likely is it that the European Union would agree to participate in a construct like this? I mean, this worry is not out of place. RCEP members had obviously decided to not integrate a mechanism to stop certain imports from certain countries at a certain point in time. Wouldn't such a mechanism be needed if RCEP wanted to enhance their relations with the European Union?
I haven't read all the pages in the RCEP agreement, but I let me put it this way. I think a lot of this concern arise from a certain insecurity when your economy is not competitive enough. And I think sometimes you need this kind of agreements to catalyze also domestic reforms in order to make the economy more competitive. And there will always be some sectors, there will be sectors that may not. So it is then up to the national governments to say, you know, because you will never win in all sectors, right? So you have to say there are some gains in here, but then how do you compensate the losers? And of course, this need to be then, to me, what national governments need to do. But overall, I think it is a win-win for most, for those who participate. So I think you have to look at it in that way, that the agreement, everyone benefited from different perspective, from different sectors, different perspective. And it has to be on balance. Also the political will to make the reforms necessary in order to benefit from the agreement.
Now, I am one of the people who believe that the unipolar world order as we knew it is over. The United States, for me, is not the major superpower, the sole superpower on the planet. US soft power is strongly declining. We see that the production of the United States compared to other countries is not high enough to justify its position in the global financial markets. When it comes to providing the US dollar as the global reserve currency, we know for a fact that one of the major reasons why the US dollar is still the main reserve currency is the fact that the majority of oil trades and natural gas trades are actually conducted in US dollar. But even this is declining, and the reason for that is that many Asian countries are challenging the status. Looking at Iran, who have started to trade in outside the US dollar system. Even Saudi Arabia, a close ally, conducts trade in Chinese yuan with the Chinese government, and others do as well. Now, are we witnessing the birth pangs of a new Asian century in which not only our Western perception of Asia is rising, but also Caucasian countries, North Asian countries, countries in the Middle East, that are increasingly important when it comes to linking the East and the West through the Chinese BRI, and they will also likely benefit from the incoming investments and the incoming money. The question here would be, looking at the Middle East and comparing to ASEAN, how does ASEAN benefit from the BRI, and which strategic role does it play, again, of course, for China, in this trade construct?
I don't want to use the word Asian century because it has been used so often, right? So I will say that, you know, to me, Asia has always been multipolar.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have the different powers, right? Asia has always been multipolar. And that, in some way, allow us not to be complacent. Mm-hmm. We always have to be on our toes.
Yeah, I understand.
Right? We do not. So because it has always been the multipolar, there's always this rivalry between different powers, between India and China and Japan and Korea. So that, in some way, keep us on our toes, and so that we are not complacent. And I think that, in a way, is to some extent, that kind of competition, as long as it doesn't become too sharp or too that leads to, you know, it's good. A certain level of competition, I think, is always good. So it keeps us and energized, and will continue to do something to maintain stability and all that. So, but going back to whether, you know, the Asian connections, you know, we have this whole connectivity agenda, you talk about the BI, I think it's very real. There's a lot of infrastructure needs that are being attend to. Of course, we still need more. And I think ASEAN, of course, welcomes China's Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And in fact, ASEAN has been at the forefront of this connectivity agenda. It was ASEAN who was the one who rolled out this first master plan on connectivity in 2010. And many ASEAN states are, of course, taking advantage, again, of this competing connectivity agenda being offered by various major powers in the region. So they are not only looking into the Chinese BRI, they are also looking at Japan's partnership for quality infrastructure. And now, of course, the European Union is also trying to come into the game with their connecting strategy on connecting Europe and Asia. So I think we benefit from this kind of competition where the major powers are coming up with initiatives and realize that to connect this region, in whether it's in trade, through the railways, it's important because the potential, the economic potential will increase, right, with all these connections.
Absolutely, it's huge, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Despite the fact that China is increasing their influence, you don't necessarily see that as a problem, right?
No, we do not like to see things as a threat. We always see things as a, yes, it can be a challenge. There will always be the negative and the positive. And it's how you try and balance and leverage and try and get the most out of it. I think the worst is when a country has no options.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So we actually welcome the different attention that has been given to the region now. Of course, it is complex. You need to be to be alert.
Yeah.
To be able to leverage and make sure you don't get caught. You know, as I say, when the opportunity is not, you need to have know when to open it or open the door, and you must be ready to
absolutely.
Take advantage of it, right?
So. Now, in your book, ASEAN-EU Partnership, you identify, obviously, synergies between the European Union and ASEAN and RCEP, and to an extent. So the two most dominant regional blocs in the world. What would you say are the main synergies that both should leverage to benefit?
So I think the two, like I said, the two blocs believe in continue to believe in an open trading system, the rule of law. So these are areas that we are trying to continue to work. In fact, the last recently we just have the so-called 23rd ASEAN EU ministerial meeting on the 1st of December. An online meeting, but they have now upgraded their relationship to a strategic partnership, making the commitment to say that there should also be partners in connectivity. And so you can see that the EU is also becoming aware of the potential and making efforts to really engage the region here, engage ASEAN in order to they are really now also in what I would call the geopolitical and the geoeconomics game, right? It's the strategy. And they look at ASEAN as a region where they should focus their attention.
Now, concluding this tremendously interesting discussion, if you had a wish list of, let's say, 3 points that you could make and that would come true for the ASEAN-European partnership and also for the development of RCEP with regards to the European Union. What would these wishes be?
Three wishes. On RCEP, I want ASEAN to continue to own the initiative and to pay attention to the implementation of RCEP so that it will really bring about the benefits that has been promised. So that's one. The second wish is that I hope the ASEAN-EU FTA negotiations will start and be concluded as soon as possible. And then the third wish I have is that I think regional organizations like ASEAN and EU should really take more initiative and play what we call, what I call functional leadership role, and not wait and believe that leadership only comes from the big powers. I think there is much for us to be more proactive, and leadership now comes in many forms.
And who
we should have leadership in what I call functional areas, where you have climate change. Both EU and ASEAN are committed to a green recovery post-pandemic. So I think in the areas, for instance, on climate change and all that, you know, we can take functional leadership in these areas. So I do not think we should leave leadership to the big powers. Regional organizations should really step up and become much more important players on their own right.
And which country could that be from your point of view? Is there one country that could take leadership in coordinating these efforts? For instance, Singapore being a country that has close interests and close relations to both sides?
So again, as I have already said, you know, ASEAN is a flexible, very flexible organization. We always have leadership based on issues. So we call issue-based leadership. It's not leadership by power or by size, right? So depending on the issue, so in some issues, say maybe on financial issues, maybe Singapore will take the leadership. On issues on biodiversity and all that, it could be another ASEAN member state. So I think this is the way ASEAN has worked, and hopefully it will continue to work in this, because this kind of flexible and leadership, issue-based leadership has always served the ASEAN well, and not leadership based on power or size.
Now, obviously, as part of the Global Diplomatic Forum, where we regularly have the Young Diplomats Forum, bringing together people from all over the world, with regards to young leaders in ASEAN, and there are many, and I've been delighted enough to meet and some of them and to call some of them also good friends of mine. What would you say, what do you expect and what do you wish from these young leaders in ASEAN to benefit and to contribute to the development of this this region?
I would like to see more intra-ASEAN education mobility. So far, we have a lot of course, young people aspiring to have an education in the United States or going to Europe. But I think one way for us to really develop is like what the European did with the Erasmus program and all that, that we will have our own ASEAN Erasmus program, or we will find a name for it. It will not be called Erasmus. And to encourage more educational mobility within ASEAN for young people. And I would like ASEAN young people to really travel more around also in the region, which has already happened. Because of the low-cost airlines like Air Asia and all that, and hopefully that will continue, because this will be one of those that will create an ASEAN identity.
That is a great conclusion for our discussion. Maybe one remark about that, within our community, that is something that happened in the last few years. We've seen that quite a lot. So we've seen friends of mine and, of course, colleagues from the Global Diplomatic Forum have set up forums in Thailand, in India even, and people from all over the world, also from ASEAN countries, participated and visited each other. So I think that is always a good way to build a common identity, to build common goals, to build a common strategy. And for all our listeners, it's obviously great to hear this motivational speech from somebody like you, who is a very esteemed person in this topic.
In fact, if I may, just to have a last word, is that we are even hopefully thinking that there is a possibility of one day we could have an ASEAN Peace Corps, where young people from ASEAN, you know, get together to contribute to also other regions and work together on projects in other regions. And I think, you know, so the ASEAN Peace Corps idea has been floating. I hope one day it can be realized.
I think these are the perfect concluding remarks. Dr. Lei Wee Yeo, thank you so much for your valuable time. It was a pleasure talking to you. We learned a lot today about ASEAN's role in the regional balance of power, in the Asian balance of power, and of course also looking at the global balance of power and the new developments with RCEP and how the European Union and other major stakeholders are viewing this agreement and these developments. One information to our audience, Dr. Lei Wei-Yo's book ASEAN-EU Partnership is currently available to be purchased at a 20% discount if you type in the code AEUP20. Dr. Lei Wei, thank you again very much and hope to speak to you soon and to stay in touch and continue to observe the very interesting developments in the region.
Thank you for having me, Martin, and keep safe.
Thank you very much.
Keep well. Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, dear friends, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Good Governance Partnership podcast. Stay safe, stay healthy, and all the best. This is Martin El-Khoury from the Good Governance Partnership, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you very soon. Take care and goodbye.